The project was a challenge in that we didn't, there was no book you could go to read up on what you're going to, do and what, and there's no book you could go to for anyone who ever tried to take it to, such high power levels in such a short period, in seconds. They take hours or more to do it in, in a nuclear power
plant. So nobody had done that with the nuclear reactor?
No, the only other people working on one were Los Alamos, and they were pretty secretive about what they're doing, and I did go out and visit them, but they were not too open. The two labs were very, very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically you were, you're doing a project where you don't know in advance, what everything you could expect. And it isn't to say that you don't do experiments before, you take this thing to full power to make sure, that you can control what you got. But there's that element there always. And the first time to full power is a pretty, hairy time in that, we knew we could hang on to it even if it had no delayed neutrons. But you knew you had sort of a bomb on your hands rather than an easily controlled nuclear reactor.
Right.
And so we were really, I was learning the nucleonics, if you would,
mm-hmm.
and had, at the lab, had there were a lot of people, and my colleague, Mike Uthe, who ultimately went with me to SRI and EAI, he was a nuclear engineer from the Air Force Institute.
Oh, and was he in the physics division as well, or?
Yeah, he was. We were both, and we had offices side by side, and he knew that end of it really well, and so we were a good team. And,
right.
And I could get him to explain it in words that I could understand, and equations, that we could put into our analog simulations,
mm-hmm.
or digital simulations. But we used a lot of analog simulation and a lot of digital simulation, and the lab just had incredible facilities in that regard. We bought a lot of it ourselves, a lot of the, like the analog computers that we used, and that was, it was paramount, so the background I had really was helpful with both digital and analog computers.
Now, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, for the ramjet, you know how to build a nuclear reactor, so there, but to make a reactor, just in terms of reactor design,
mm-hmm.
one that'll fly has some different specifications.
Yeah.
It sounds like, in thinking about it, that the control systems are going to be one of the major, one of the rate limiters, solving that control problem for the project as a whole, because that's where a lot of innovation has to take place.
Mm-hmm.
To take it, to be able to control the reactor over such a, what would you call it?
Rapid excursion.
Yeah, over those quick changes in the range. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah.
Control systems is a critical.
Right, it was, because it had a limited, it had maybe 3 minutes of air that you, a supply of air that would last 3 minutes, allow you to stay at full power for 3 and maybe 4 minutes at the most. And so you had to have a safe way of getting it from, say, 1 megawatt to 300 megawatts, which is a hell of an excursion, and hold it there and then get it back down without thermally stressing the reactor. And the problem is, if you thermally stress it, if you don't do this at the exact right rate, it's going to cause thermal expansion, of fuel elements, things that will crack there.
Yeah.
And basically destroy the reactor, because and the reactor itself was a challenge, I have to say, to build with 100,000 or more fuel elements that have a hole going down the center element. But it was the experiment was not possible, I would say, in a practical sense, without a very good control system. And so that's what we had to build, and we didn't really have any precedent for that. And especially on Torrey 2C, where it was all built using pneumatic actuators that were running, you know, cherry red, in fact.
Right.
And this was in 1962 and 3, and so when we were doing the flight version of it.
And you tested the Torrey 2C in 62?
62, 63. I think actually went on in 63, and I went back to work at the test site during that period from SRI. And, we basically built that whole system, and we're waiting to test the reactor at the time I left the lab. But it was a real challenge, and the lab was a pretty, I would say, wonderful place to work.
That was my next question about it as an environment to work.
Yeah, the head of the lab, when I got there, I think it was Herb York, who was, 28 or something like that, and he was young, and everybody, was in their 20s, or early 30s. And so, and my director, Ted Merkel, he was about 32, I think,
right.
And I was 25, I guess. No, I was older than that when I arrived here. But let's see, it was in 57, so I was 30 years old.
Right.
Yeah, and I was almost 30 anyway. And I was, I wasn't the youngest guy around, but at that time, I guess most of the people on the project were in their 30s, and probably you have to look to find somebody in their 40s.
Right.
And
I was wondering, Herbert Brown ran Livermore, right? Is that later on in the 60s?
The first director was Herb York.
Herb York.
And Harold Brown.
Harold. I'm conflating the two.
Herb York was first director, and he became president of one of the Caltech or something. They both became deputy, the head of DOD R&D.
Right.
Yeah, and the first DOD R&D head was Herb York.
Okay.
And he was succeeded by Harold Brown, who was the director after he left, who was succeeded by Johnny Foster, who was director after Harold Brown left.
Okay.
And these were all, they were all in the bomb end of the business there. And
I guess Harold Brown is the person I'm more familiar with, and he was an extremely young man.
Oh, yeah.
I had even written down a young man's game, with
right.
a question mark here on my notes, because I wondered if it was diffused across the whole shop.
It was, when I arrived at the lab, I think there were 600 people there, and we used to have colloquiums every other week or sometimes every week, and, where you could, you were invited sort of to it, and if you were in the professional ranks, you were welcome to go, and there you got to mingle with Edward Teller and
Ryan
Herb York and Bill Brown and all these people, and that were pretty outstanding. I mean, they're all very young, and so they were probably my age, or give or take, and probably most of them a couple of years older. But we used to have guests, and Hans Bethe, Isda Rabi, and almost all of them had Nobel Prizes, and Herman Kahn, they always had somebody, pretty outstanding, and Edward. And Edward Teller and Harold Brown would sit in the front row and drill them when they're through talking. But it was a great experience in that you were, you're welcomed into a very small group that was really good. And the topics range, sometimes it's about you know, nuclear weapons, and sometimes it's about other things. Everything, we were always in a classified area, so there was no limit on what we could talk about.
Right.
And we were, the way the lab ran, it was kind of cutthroat in that if you screwed up on your job, you got fired. Mm. And he knew that, and it was just, that's just the way it was, you know. And you were expected to know everything in your area, and periodically had to report within your division. Our division would have, maybe once a year or less, would have to report on the status of the control systems, and with numerous reports that are coming in, that were written along the way, and where you were quizzed at some length and some depth by your colleagues and by the director. The head of our project was the director of the lab. And then periodically we presented to the top people at the lab. And before we could run a reactor, we had people like, at that time it was either Harold Brown or Johnny Foster, and Dwayne Sewell, who was the operations manager of the lab. We had to present to them what we were doing, why, you know, show that it was safe, and withstand a barrage of questions from really, really intelligent people. And if you couldn't stand the flak, you know, you just better leave, because it was, if you couldn't convince them that what you had was really safe, they weren't going to let you run it.
Hmm.
And I mean, it was a responsibility they had, and so we, and we also had to present this to the project officers from AEC Air
right.
Force, and it was it really, you were accountable for what you did, and if you didn't, you know, if you screwed up, you just knew you're going to leave, whether you're an Air Force officer or a member of the lab. I mean, it was just known, and that's the way it was. And so it was a good environment, but you had complete freedom to screw up. And so that, for me, was a real turning point in my career, I think. You were with probably the smartest people in the world, and amongst the smartest
mm-hmm.
people in the world. Well, you know, plenty of Nobel Prizes amongst your audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were, you were matching wits some of the time with them, but most of the time with your nose to the grindstone, doing, you know, making sure that what you're doing is right and it's going to work. And we had to present to the Air Force, too. And we had an Air Force general who ultimately was in charge of the whole thing, and whom we all, you know, presented our results, you know, our systems, and explained, you know, why they were going to work. And ultimately, a lot of the money was coming out of his office.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, when we were talking about your high school experience and sort of the sense of urgency that characterized that point in time, you know, while the war was on,
mm-hmm.
the things, what reading I have done about the history of Livermore during this period is that there was a similar sense of urgency at that laboratory, you know, and so
yeah.
when you made your comment about if you don't do well in your job, you're just out. It's, I was wondering if you thought part of that, I'm sure, is this sort of you know, very high performers working together
uh-huh.
sort of situation. But do you think it also was that sense of urgency? You know, this is a dicey time in the world.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was. I think so. And you know, we realized, you know, we're potentially in a fight with the Russians, and that, you know, what we were doing was, you know, was pretty important, and thank God it never was needed,
mm-hmm.
that weapon system, because it's a terrible weapon system. But I think at the lab, it was, you know, you're sort of with an elite group of people, and you just don't want to fail.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, just your pride is driving you more than anything. And the fact that you have, you know, even brighter people than you've ever seen before around you makes you all the more want to succeed and do not just well, but do outstandingly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of the culture of the lab, especially in the early days, that you strive to be, you know, distinguished and not just passing.
Right.
And at the lab, passing is a failing grade, sort of. In our part of it, anyway. I would just say, though, that your own pride and it was an important part of it, that you just had to do well. I mean, that's all there was to it. And you had all the opportunities and whatever, you know, money you needed or help or whatever. And I pretty much hired most of the people that were working in my area, whether I was an Air Force officer or a civilian. I stayed on as a civilian for the last 2 years I was at the lab. And so I couldn't complain, you know, that I chose people from the EE department and the ME department, the people that have worked for me, most of them worked for, you know, for one of those departments, one of those two departments, in the formal sense, you know, they were assigned full-time under my, in my group, in our division. And we were a close-knit team. And I'd say the whole, the leader of our activity, Ted Merkel, was a good leader and extremely brilliant and demanding and, you know, unforgiving in some way. But a good sense of humor.
So in 59 then, you had to really make a decision about your Air Force career? Is that around the time, or 1960?
Yeah, I was 59.
Uh-huh.
I was facing a tour of duty going back to Washington to be the project officer on the project that I was working on.
Oh.
And whether I was immediately that or ultimately that, I didn't even find out. But I would become an administrative person in essence. The fellow who had that job was a West Pointer from the same class. I knew him from our first assignment. And I knew what his job was, and I didn't have any interest in it at all. And it was a situation where also we were, I think we had about 5 children by then.
Mm.
And we really were tight. Things were pretty tight in terms
right.
of dollars and cents. And I didn't really want to leave the lab in the middle of the project. And so I decided to... And I talked to my bosses at Kirtland, and they said that, you know, more or less that the job you have right now, it would be the equivalent responsibility of a colonel in the Air Force, and you're a captain, and that's, you know, you're going to have to accept some comedowns in what, you know, in responsibility.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in the amount of dollars you control or
right.
whatever, but at the lab, I would start out as a senior scientist, and I was classified at the top rating in the lab when I switched over.
Mm.
I did the same job before and after, but it was more responsibility than I would probably have had in the Air Force as a captain. And so I didn't really run into any resistance at all. They said, you know, we really hate to lose you as, you know, but we, both of them had worked at the lab and knew, you know, really knew
right.
from firsthand. And they were both generals by then, I think, or one of them was a general and the other was becoming a general. And they really didn't fight. I really said, you know, this is what I want to continue, and I really I went with their blessing.
Mm.
Maybe they want to get rid of me.
And so the Tori-2C project is the device is complete in 62. You don't get to
right.
test it till 63. But
right.
So there's a natural closure to the project.
Right, and my part was finished.
Okay.
When I left, I finished that. We had the whole our whole part of the system running, and we're waiting. Coors were making our reactors, Coors porcelain, and so I was, and that took a little longer than was expected. So we had our part actually up and running, and you know by the time I left the lab, and so it was a logical time for me.
Is Coors porcelain the same people who make the who made you the quadrupoles?
Right, they are.
Later on,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. We, in fact, hired the very group in the Finnegan that made our quadrupoles, that made our fuel elements.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Did, yeah.
I'm
the,
sorry.
The guy in charge, a guy named Bob Smith, was, you know, the guy in charge of making these. Our last reactor, I think, was made up of 200,000 fuel elements.
Oh,
about
my gosh.
4 inches long with a hole down the center for cooling. And so they built a whole plant for that. That was Coors porcelain. It was bed walls that were 8 feet thick or something.
Wow.
And but anyway, that same group is were the ones that we used to build to make our ceramics at Finnegan.
Now was there? Sorry, I just the name rung.
And you're pretty sharp.
Well, I was reading things again today before coming over, so it's short-term memory now.
Yeah.
To go back, was there a chance to stay on at Livermore in 62, or did they make you an offer there?
Yeah, I was offered the head of all of electrical engineering by the lab, and it's sort of a phase in, and they had somebody, you know, there that they wanted to phase out.
Right.
And I was, the director of the lab made me this offer, and I thought about it pretty seriously before deciding, you know, to move to SRI.
And what was the, how did that conversation start with SRI? I mean, you know, you're weighing the two options, I guess, between staying or going.
I had talked to SRI earlier when I thought I might be leaving the Air Force and before we got into all the testing stuff at Livermore. And I had talked to them, and they had sort of made me a standing offer and then had called me periodically to, you know, to say we're really still interested in having you come. And so I was aware, you know, that there was, you know, an opportunity that was, you know, completely different, and you know, and hence, and not aerospace oriented. It was a part of SRI that didn't do any aerospace work, and I always felt that thing would never fly. Because it was too dangerous, the nuclear ramjet, and there was no place to launch it, and you know, and so on. And I felt it was I wouldn't say a dead end project, but that at some point you'd wind up having to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I considered the management sort of position there, which was, I don't know, 1,000 people by then. It was a large group. But it didn't really appeal to me.
So being the head of electrical engineering there would be 100%. Well, you would be working on projects.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be administrative.
Okay. And the About SRI, their standing offer was to come and work on process control systems, just control system research, or they'd give you a group or something?
Yeah, they wanted me to set up a process controls group within the control systems lab.
Okay.
And which was the group that did IRMA, the Bank of America project.
Okay.
And I'd met a lot of those people in had interviewed, you know, over there, and I knew a little bit about it, not a whole lot, but I saw it as something completely different, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and more practical, let's say more civilian oriented in terms of projects and,
right.
and so on. But I, you know, leaving the lab wasn't easy. It was such a good place to work, but it seemed to me that it was, let's say, you're devoting your career to military type projects, and that's the way it is. And
mm-hmm.
that's what the lab has always done, and it's what it will probably always do. So I didn't take the job.
Right. Your collaborator, Mike, how do you pronounce it?
Uthi.
He left Livermore to go with you?
Right.
Up to SR?
Yep.
Okay, and to continue your working together?
Right. We really got along well, and I think we both were ready. I guess we both felt that the project at Livermore was going to come to an end, and, you know, turned out Harold Brown was the one who killed it.
Hmm.
That he was Secretary of the Air Force at the time.
Oh, right.
And decided that, you know, this didn't really make that much sense to keep going when it got to the expensive stage. And when it had already been getting to prove feasibility and building the prototype, you know, was a lot less expensive than once you go into flying one of these things,
right.
which is the next logical step. And so anyway, we both we decided to go to SRI to pursue process controls. And we had considered starting a company with some colleagues from Bendix Research Labs who were helping as a contractor to me to build the pneumatic controls that we used on Torrey-2C, and we had talked about a company, and I looked at other opportunities with EG&G,
mm-hmm.
Who had various things they wanted to do, and we talked about starting an operation for them here in the Bay Area, but ultimately went to SRI instead. And
could you tell me a little bit about I don't know as much as I should about SRI at that time or any other, really. So could you tell me a little bit of, about it as you came to join it? Just sort of its size, what the, you know, its nature as an organization, and then as a place to do forward-looking research.
Yeah, in this period, which is 1962, SRI was the premier research institute in the world. And it really was. And it probably the only competitor was Battelle,
mm-hmm.
you know, at that time.
Right.
And there were other research institutes. But SRI was probably half military, doing half military work, and half you know, commercial kinds of projects like the Bank of America project.
And these are very sort of cutting edge contract
right.
research projects.
Right.
Okay.
Really cutting edge.
Right.
And they were a lot of, you know, and there were projects like the Quadrupole that were getting money from the aerospace or, you know, they're getting it from U.S., the Naval Office,
right.
Naval Research, NASA, people like that. And but they were also trying to do a project, you know, microelectronics that would have commercial implications.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, I would say though that at least half the money came from the military, NASA,
sure,
and so on. They were probably, at that time I went there, they were probably 2,000 people strong and probably $100 million or more dollars in revenues. But it was really a premier place. I mean, they were doing work all the way from economics, market studies, management systems like my brother,
mm-hmm,
all the way to almost pure research, way out research like Doug Engelbart, that, to be in 62 having a PC running on your desk is pretty far out.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, even to his boss. And so I would just say it really had an outstanding reputation, and they had good people in the control systems area, and in instrumentation kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was just a good research institute, the best I think, and it was here, right here on the peninsula, and still is, and I would say it represented almost a 180 degree change from what I had been doing.
In terms of